Bill Alcoholic?
No.
Just changed my whole pitch. It's a cheap shot, the fathers and the kids. And the one this morning with the school and the getting back and regaining your life and all that crap. My sponsor's giving me direction. It never stops. I'd like to thank Keith and Sally for thinking of me and inviting me down here. This is really an honor to be here. This is a hotbed of AA soldierdom. And, you know, to be able to come here and share with you is really, truly an honor. And there's some people here that mean an awful lot to me. Keith and Sally are one of them. I hope someday if I'm able to stay sober that I can get as much pleasure out of AA after all these years that that they do. I think it's really, it's fun. It's something to shoot for, you know. Alex being here. Alex has been very special to me over the years. My mother's here. And her best friend. You know? And, so I got to be sure I don't say fuck. Well, that's over. A couple things. I have opinions, and I'd like to apologize for that up front. You know, you hear a lot of people around Alcoholics Anonymous will say that the longer they're sober, the less they know, and that just hasn't happened to me yet. As a matter of fact, I really wonder about those people, you know? Like, aren't they paying attention? Right? I mean, you can learn some stuff just coming to meetings. You don't even have to get involved. I mean, just through osmosis, you'll get something, you know? It's like, I've been wide awake this last 15 years. It's been really interesting. You know, I know a hell of a lot more about living sober than I did 15 years ago. I'm going to burden you with some of that tonight, some of my opinions. The other thing is I have absolutely no problem whatsoever speaking for you. You know, some people say, Bill, you should just talk in the first person. Well, I can't seem to do that. I know really what's good for you. And I figure on top of that you're just like me. That if it's good for me, it probably is good for you. You know, I would hope, I think one of the things that you hear people share a lot about when they come to AA and they finally settle in is they find their group. They find people that are just like them. And I truly believe you're just like me. As a matter of fact, I've learned a lot about myself through your eyes. So I don't have a problem speaking for you, because I think what's good for me is good for you. So I'd like to apologize for that as well. I have a father. I had a father. He died last year. He was 45 years sober when he passed away, which is hard to imagine, you know, not drinking for that length of time. So I grew up in Alcoholics Anonymous, literally. I grew up in AA. I was 6 years sober when he got sober, and I was 6 years old when he got sober. And I think I was sober. I think so. You know, I think I was pretty sure. I do remember, the only thing I really remember about his drinking was one time in particular, I remember him sitting at the kitchen table with a big rectangular bottle of some kind of liquor, and he let me smell it. And I go, God, anybody that would drink that's got to be nuts, you know, I mean. And but he was a bar drinker. He was away from home mostly. I don't remember any alcoholic insanity in the house of drunkenness or anything like that. But at 6 years old, he got struck sober. And I got raised at AA. I mean, what you did 45 years ago, there weren't many meetings around, so you went around and started meetings and tried to connect the dots, you know, of different little groups of AA around, and they took me with them. My mother helped found the Al-Anon Central Office in L.A., and she got very active. They used to speak together AA and Al-Anon, which was pretty controversial some years ago. I mean, people didn't like that. You know, people had opinions, believe it or not, back then in AA. And they were a little rigid. And so I grew up in the kitchens of AA meetings and bringing out the coffee and the donuts. And I'd come home from school and there'd be some guy laying on the back porch. Sometimes he was drunk, sometimes he was sober. One guy was laying on the back porch and he was all drunk and hung over, and I got him and brought him in the house and cleaned his ass up before my dad got home. You know, you can't look like that. You know, and I mean, I grew up in a house where the big books were in the house and they were open. You know, I mean, a lot of people grew up in houses with big books and they were coasters, you know, and I mean, this was before the hospitals had figured out how to make money out of us. So when you went on a 12-step call, you brought them home. And I can remember being in the living room and having to leave the other room. And my dad would go on a 12-step call and bring some guy back. And they'd sit and pound on the book and point their finger at him and tell him the same lame-ass stuff we tell him today. You know, I mean, not much has changed, really. I mean, there's a lot of psychobabble that's come into Alcoholics Anonymous. Some of it's good. You know, but the message is the same. The message is the same. If you study a little bit about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and about the Oxford group and stuff, my sponsor does a really good, interesting, good seminar about that connection between the Oxford group and AA and where the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous came from. And what those people believed in was what they called one-on-one evangelism. One-on-one. They didn't recover them in tents. In crowds, it was one-on-one. You gave your testimony. They had house parties and they shared. And if there was somebody that had a drinking problem, they hooked them up with somebody else that had a drinking problem. They sobered up a lot of people. They sobered up Evie, Roland Hazard, and Clancy gave a little history of AA. That's where these people got sober. When they formed Alcoholics Anonymous, they used Oxford group literature in the meetings. They tried a lot of stuff that didn't work. You know, you had to give yourself over to Jesus before you could go to the AA meeting. You didn't get too many people in the AA meeting, you know. I mean, some of it worked and some of it didn't. But that's what they did, one-on-one. And that message is still as pure and true and clean as it was then. It's the same thing. It's one alcoholic talking to another. That's what it is. There's only one program in Alcoholics Anonymous. There isn't a different program for every person in AA. But we'd sure like there to be, wouldn't we? I mean, there should be a special little program just for Bill, you know? And I've tried that a few times, you know? But there's only one. That's an opinion. So I grew up in AA. I don't recommend it. You know? I mean, you know, AA isn't real. It's where you go to get help. You know, and when you live in a house with two people with clear eyes that know exactly what's going on in your head, it's painful. You know, my parents were two of the most boring people I've ever met in my life. Nothing ever happened. So when it was my turn, I did it with a vengeance. You know, I've talked to a lot of kids that grew up in AA, and you can be around the program. I've been to all the, you know, now I know why we were always going to goddamn Bakersfield. It was a Southern California convention. You know, I had to get sober to find out, why are we going to Bakersfield all the time? There's no good reason to go to Bakersfield, you know? And I've been to the roundups and the barbecues, and I knew you weren't just a bunch of old people hanging on to each other with overcoats under bridges not drinking, you know? I mean, because I'd been to all the parties and the barbecues and the weddings and the funerals and all that stuff, you know. And when it was my turn to be, kids growing up around that, you don't really know the program. You just know that you're around AA. But you're not reading the book. You don't have a sponsor, you know. I mean, you're not trying to work out your problems, you know. You don't have any problems. You're just a kid. Kids are supposed to have problems. It just doesn't look good when you're 40 to be having the same damn problems, you know. There's a gap there of about 20 years. I can remember waiting around for when I was going to drink. You know, and the first night I got drunk and I crawled down the hallway of my house and I threw up in my record player. Well, it had a lid on it. And I crawled down the hall. That's when the records were big. I crawled down the hall and I'm sitting in the bathroom and I had a trash can between my legs because it was coming out both ends, and The bathroom door opened up, and there was my mother and father. My mother standing there with this aghast expression on her face, and my dad standing behind her laughing hysterically. Oh, my God, we've got our own little in-house alcoholic. And it went from there. By the time I was 17 years old, I was a bad drunk in high school. I went to my 20-year reunion right after I got sober, soon after I got sober, and I was standing around talking with some guys, and I was in a car club at the time in high school. And I was talking to this one guy, and I said, God, remember every weekend we had a party, we were just drunk every weekend. Remember? He goes, oh, I wasn't drinking. I go, what do you mean? You were with me every weekend. He goes, Bill, you were drinking. Isn't it interesting how we don't notice a lot of stuff going on around us, you know? Our relationship, the depth of my shallowness knows no bounds. You know? We just don't connect, you know? We just don't. But I'm a child of the 60s, you know? I graduated from high school in 1965. And it was a great time. You know, you'll hear people say, you know, I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day. I wouldn't trade 66 and 67 for anything. Party! It was really cool. And we were cute, you know? We were cute. Every decade since has wanted to be the 60s, you know? And we were cool. And we had long hair and Holy Levi's and Paisley and stuff, you know? The road from Los Angeles to San Francisco was the road to Nirvana. Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe. It was summertime all the time. You know, they weren't eating hitchhikers yet, so it was safe to travel. You know? The young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could. Trying to rise to the occasion. It was really a party. It was, you know, they weren't cutting the LSD with speed, and, you know, the junkies hadn't taken over the world yet, you know. I mean, there was a couple of years, there was a window of a couple of years there where, you know, and then it went south, you know. I wish I remembered the 60s more. You know, I mean, you tell stories long enough, they become true, you know. You tell them long enough. I mean, there's a couple of things that I really hope are true. I hope they happened, you know, because they're really good stories. But honestly, some of it, I'm not really sure. You know, I'm not, you know. One of the speakers this weekend was talking about, you know, I don't remember my childhood. You know, I mean, I really, and there's parts of it, you know, that are very gray. I don't remember a lot of what went on, really. But, you know, my whole story is, and I don't have much of a story. I mean, thank God there's some people in AA that actually did some stuff, you know? So we have stories to listen to, because most of us, like, nothing really happened. You know, nothing happened. I mean, I was loaded. It's hard to do shit when you're face down. You know, it's like, I mean, you're like in the vicinity where it happened, you know? I mean, it's, but you're not really a participant, you know? It's, in the area, I was in San Francisco, I'm sure of that, you know. But I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy, and I rarely went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran, and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat, and wore a primary chain for a belt, and black greasy Levi's, big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. That's true. It's true. So I look good. But like most of you, I was full of shit. I mean, you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, you have to take on someone else's personality till you get one of your own. Don't you think, really? I mean, really. Most of us are pretty chameleonic out there, you know. You know, I heard Bobby Early, I don't think that's really a word, chameleonic, is it? Kind of fits, though. Heard Bobby Earl talk about, you know, doing the, you know, when you're out there drinking and doing your thing, you walk into a room and you look around the room and you kind of hang back and you listen to how people are talking and what they're doing. You rehearse it in your head a little bit and then you jump out there and you talk like they're talking and, you know, that kind of thing. And when you come into AA, that doesn't change. You know, I mean, you have no self-esteem, no self-respect, and no self-confidence. You know, you pretend, you fake it. You have no other choice because there's no depth to any of us, really. And that's what was going on out there. I mean, at the time, I didn't think that. I figured I was real, you know. I mean, I thought that's what a man was an outlaw biker. I remember being at Bass Lake on the 4th of July in 1965, and the Hell's Angels rode in that valley, and I went, yes, sir. I want to be just like that. I want to be a gangster, a gunslinger. You know, that's what I want to be. That's what a man is. That's what I want to be. And I went for that for a long time, you know. It's just, I'm not like that at all. I'm a wimp. You know? What can I say, you know? I mean, who knew? You don't know, you know. I didn't know that, and I figured I was real, you know. So, remember the party? Remember the party? Remember the whole idea was to have a party. That was the whole idea. The whole idea was to have a few beers, you know, I mean, we feel less than, not part of, and aliens from other planets. And you have a few beers and you feel good and you jump out there, maybe you get laid, you know? You never know. You know, but at least it got you out of the house, you know? It gets you out of the house and you're out among people and doing stuff. And I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. Party! What the hell is that? What happened to the party? But, you know, good alcoholics stay out there for an extra 3 to 5 years. You know, you wouldn't want to leave just before the miracle. They might all line up again, you know, looking for some action, and they want you, you know. But you got to make damn sure you're miserable. Make damn sure you wouldn't want to come in early. I have hepatitis C, and I'm taking the medication for that. I never thought I'd ever stick a needle in myself again, but I have to shoot myself with interferon 3 days a week and take capsules and pills, and they make me very emotional. I'm a very emotional girl right now. And I want to give you fair warning, because I spoke at another meeting a few weeks ago, and I screamed at him for 45 minutes. I heard the tape of that and I go, who the hell was that? You know? So if anybody out there has it and they'd like to talk about that, I'm available. It's tough, you know? It's tough. And there's a lot of it in AA. No one gets away free. It's that extra 3 to 5 years. You get hurt. Alcoholism, active alcoholism, drinking alcoholism is not funny. The reason you and I laugh is because it's not like that anymore. And we identify with what it was like. But when you're out there peeing on yourself and walking into doors and making a fool of yourself in public, it's not funny. Tonight maybe we'll talk a little bit about the demon and about the exorcism of said demon. Because I've seen the demon. If you've ever been on a 12-step call, get up real close to him so you can smell him. And you look him in the eye. You tell me if you can't see the demon. It's alive. It's real. And I've seen it in sobriety. I've seen it in people's eyes at the Alano Club. I've seen it in people that have been sober a long time. There's a lot of untreated alcoholism in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's a lot of people in AA that are on the fringe that have been sober a long time. There's lots of people get sober, get drunk at 8, 10, 15, 20 years sober. And everybody's shocked. My dad used to say, some guy's 10 years sober and he drinks, and everybody goes, isn't that shocking? My dad says, it's shocking he stayed sober for 10 years. You know? So the demon's real. We've all had the demon in our lives. We've felt it. We've felt the powerlessness. We felt being swept away. You know, some of us crossed the line. I never crossed the line. I stepped immediately over the line. But some people that drank for a while, and they tell the story of when they stepped over the line and they got swept away, and it took over their life. Alcoholism took over my life from the time I was about 15 years old. In hindsight, I can look back and see that. Well, when you have the demon, the eye can't see itself. I didn't know I had a demon. I thought, like my sponsor says, I was just a party kind of guy, you know. But I had the demon. In sobriety is when I've seen the demon. I've seen it in other people. I've sat across the table from some guy who's trying to get sober, and you have those discussions and you can see the denial. You've got to be able to rationalize and justify that kind of life. It's a hard job. It's a hard job to be sitting in an alley with your paper bag thinking, this is okay. It's really not that bad, you know. And that's a tough job. And in sobriety, it happens a lot, too. People rationalize and justify the way they live. You'll hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous that have been around for a while and they've done some work, and they go, well, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to go take care of myself now. And I thought, well, just hand them the gun. Get it over with now. You know, shoot yourself in the head. You know, I took care of myself my entire life. Finally, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I get relief from me. It's not about me. It's about you. It's not about me. I get to finally be done with that. If you ever catch yourself alone in a room thinking about your problems, get the hell out of the room. Go help somebody else think about theirs. By the time I was 22 years old, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution. I needed to rest. Anybody else here been in a mental institution? Hi. Only those of us that have been in the loony bin know that it's not that bad. Have some sparkling conversations. Great place to look for a bride. Used to sneak out of the mental institution, sneak down the street to the liquor store, get a couple of bottles of wine, go down to the basement, drink them, come back up in the mental institution and party a little. You know? Thorazine is great stuff. So I was married and I had two kids. I lost a house and a wife and a couple of kids and several jobs and some cars. And at 22 years old, I was essentially living in my car, kind of. It's not immediately obvious when you live in your car. You're just kind of going from place to place. And every once in a while, you fall asleep in the front seat. You know? But I drank for another 15 years. I didn't get sober till I was 37. You know, when I was 22, I was sticking needles in my arm every day, and it was a mess. I was a mess. I was scared to death. I was scared to death. And I was in that mental institution a couple times. I went to my first shrink, I think, when I was 13. My mother took me to a shrink. I hated my father. One of the requirements of being an alcoholic is that you hate your parents. It's not immediately, you don't know why exactly, but they're available, you know. And I really hated my dad. And she took me to a shrink, and I spent probably a couple years seeing him, maybe some length of time. I've been in group therapy for 2.5 years at one time. I've been in a mental institution a couple of times. I've been in a recovery place. I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screamed. And I know more about myself than is safe to know, actually. You know, it's a relatively limited subject, so you have to kind of make some shit up to make it interesting. But the psychotherapeutic community has always been very interested in how I felt and what I thought about how I felt. And it is my favorite subject. You know, I do psychotherapy extremely well. You know, as a matter of fact, I enjoy it. You know, and if I'm sponsoring you, you can suck me into your weirdness. I find it quite attractive. You know, I'll try and analyze you. I don't really think it's my job, but I'll give it a shot. You know, and we've gone down that road a few times, and my sponsors told me, Bill, you have absolutely nothing to offer that man. Let him go. I know I can fix him. I know I can. I'm going to save him. I have a little halfway house over my office in El Segundo. It's kind of an apartment, and we've had some interesting people stay there. I had one guy that was staying up there drinking. My sponsor said, I don't think they're supposed to drink when they're up there, are they, Bill? Well, I'm sure he'll quit sooner or later. I've almost got him fixed. I'm sure I can fix him, you know. So when it was my turn to get sober, at 37, I went into a recovery place. What, my last drunk wasn't my worst one. It was just another one. It wasn't anything special. I was remarried and I had a couple more kids, and there was that ear-splitting, shattering silence in the house where you just move around from room to room and you're not really connected. You know, it's like alcoholics know the truth of, I was completely alone. And I lived in a house with a wife and children, and I had no emotional connection to another living human being, including my own children. There's no connection. Only an alcoholic knows the truth of that. We just don't connect. There's not room for you in me. I'm consumed with myself, absolutely consumed. And an alcoholic at the end of his drinking is completely and entirely consumed. There's no space for you. You know, I try. I look like I'm grown up. I've been around, you know. I mean, I know who the president is and stuff. You know, I can have a fairly intelligent conversation with you. But I'm not connected with the world at all. I'm in my own little world. And when it was time for me to get sober, when it was over and I could hear death creeping up behind me, because I weighed well over 300 pounds and I had gotten thrown out of a second-story bar and shattered my ankle. Have you ever been right and in the hospital? That's a common thing for alcoholics. Well, yeah, he tried to kill me, but I was right, you know. And I got into a political discussion, and always stay on the ground floor of bars. Key thing. And so I walked with a pronounced limp. The muscles in my upper body had atrophied, and I had a pinched nerve in my right shoulder. My right arm was curled up against my side, and it was hard for me to reach out to even shake your hand. And I really think my liver stuck out on one side, and now I know why. And I could feel death coming up. I just knew it was impending. I had that feeling. And I called the one person I figured would come and get me. I called my mother. No one loves you like your mother. You know, and she came and got me and checked me into a place in Costa Mesa called Starting Point. I spent 35 days in there. While I was in there, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. It was a piece of cardboard and some string. And I had to wear it around my neck. And in the morning, they made me pour coffee for everybody because they said I had some kind of an arrogant ego problem or something. I don't know what it was. But it was okay because it drew attention to myself, you know. But what it said on the sign was, I am not a counselor. That's the truth. I wish I'd have kept the sign. Really. Well, I used to help people do their fourth and fifth steps. And I'd say, well, put some of that shit in there. Makes them think you're telling the truth. They like to hear about that, you know? Yeah. I can sit around and talk to you about myself forever, you know? And if we run out of topic, we'll just make something up. You know, it's okay. But it was a straight-ahead place. It was 30, 35 days, And I was away from a drink or a drug for 35 days, and that was the first time since I was probably 15 years old that was true. It's a frightening place. Having no anesthetic, no tranquilizer, doing the world with naked blood. I don't do that well. Matter of fact, the times that I'd try and clean up my act, what I would do is I would just drink on the weekends. It's important if you're going to be normal that you only drink on the weekends, because normal people have jobs. And when I drink, I don't show up no matter what. You know? And normal people go to work on Monday, which is pretty stunning. And then they follow that up with Tuesday. They slide right into Wednesday. Some of them show up on Saturday for extra money or something. You know, it's amazing. And so if you're going to be normal, you can't drink during the week because you don't show up. You drink on the weekends like normal people do, and what you do during the week is you smoke pot. because it's like green and it's from God. It's not really drugs, you know. It's maintenance. It's what you do in between getting loaded, you know. Because there has to be some cushion between you and I. I can't do you just straight on. I can't do it, you know. I need some kind of cushion. So you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you or I, either one, and all of a sudden, I'm in the character defect center of the goddamn universe. And I'm going to do you? Half the time, you don't even know I'm in the room. And you're guaranteed to piss me off. The fellowship of AA is something to be survived. It won't keep me sober. We love to mindlessly chant principles before personalities. Does anybody know what that means? You'll hit on my wife. You'll borrow money from me and you won't pay it back. You won't show up to my birthday party. You know? I'll give you a job and you'll do a shitty job and somehow it'll be my fault. You know? You're guaranteed to piss me off. One night I'm leaving the Alano Club, I'm heading for my car. You pissed me off again. And I'm heading across, it's at night, and I thought, where are you going? Because, you know, there's no referrals from Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the last house on the street. This is it. When the insurance money runs out, when they're done gestalting and rolfing us, they send us to the world's aftercare program, AA. Linoleum floors and metal folding chairs for the rest of our natural lives. God forbid. So I better figure out a way to survive you. I got to figure out, I better come up with some principles, whatever that is, to survive you. Because there's nowhere else for me to go. You know, this is it. There's nowhere else to go. I've done it all. I've done like many of us have. I've done it all. And I hope this works for me. So after a couple of weeks of bumming around in AA and thinking I can't do it, what first meeting I walked into was the gong show at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club. And I'm standing in the back of the room, and you people are walking up, taking your little chips and saying, I'd like to thank God and my sponsor for my sobriety. You know? And then you did the coup de grace. Happy birthday to you. I stood in the back of the room. I said, I can't do this. I can't. You see, AA is not hip. Matter of fact, it's beyond lame. It's just, here I am in my old man's club. And I know he's up at the house just going, because that's what they do, you know. Children of alcoholics. So I'm stuck. I can't do it. I remember driving home from the Alano Club that night thinking, I really don't think I can do it. I'm hipper than this. And so a couple of weeks go by and I knew I had to get one of these sponsor things. So I see this guy floating around and we speculate on why I asked him. Still can't figure it out. And I walked up to him and I said, will you be my sponsor? And he says, I'll meet you at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club Monday night. Be there at 8 o'clock. The meeting starts at 8:30. Be there at 8, and we'll discuss it. I said, well, there's going to be a test. You know? And so I show up at the Alano Club, and he takes me around the corner of the Alano Club, and he asks me a couple of questions. First question he asked me is, he says, are you willing to go to any length for a victory over alcohol? And if there's anybody in here that's fairly new that hasn't been asked that question, I suggest to you that if someone asked you that, you just say yes. Because it's a trick question and you don't have any idea what they really mean by it. And if you say no, you have to listen to them for another 10 minutes. It can be painful. So I said, yeah, you bet. You and me, buddy.
off into the sunset, sobriety. Uh-huh. I'm ready. I'm ready. Any length. Then the second question he asked me was more of a statement than a question. He said, I noticed that when you identify yourself, you call yourself an alcoholic and an addict. I said, well, yeah, I'm from the 60s, man, you know. I did a lot of dope. So what? They taught me to do that in the hospital. So what? He says, well, I might suggest to you, if you're calling yourself an addict because you think it's a little hipper, slicker, and cooler, you might want to drop it. And be like everybody else for the first time in your life. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can remember standing there, it was in the dark, and he's a short little guy, you know. He's about that tall. He's 10 years younger than me, and he's got a full head of hair, all of which pisses me off. I remember looking down and I could feel the anger like I felt for my father. When I used to have those anger seizures, you know, I could feel the bile come up from my stomach into my neck and burn in your throat and the veins in my neck throb. You know, what was going on in my head was, who the fuck do you think you are? You know? What came out of my mouth was, okay. It's like, you know, when you're fat, bald, and 40, and you're in your old man's club, there's no debate. You know? It's like, well, what are you going to argue about? You know? Where are you going to go? And how did he know? How did he know? I mean, the last thing I wanted to be was just a drunk like the old man. I mean, at least being a dope fiend is like contemporary. It's rock and roll and shit, you know? He's like, this would be an alcohol. He took the last little bit of hip I had. I mean, there's nothing left. You're an A fucking A, man. You know? You gotta have something. You don't leave me with anything. You want me to be a sheep just like you, you know? My friend Paul says that, you know, if you're going to be a sheep, get in the center of the flock. The wolves pick them off on the outside, you know? God, the first time I heard that, I went, oh, God, you know? And driving home that night, I thought, this is going to be hard. How did he know? How did he know? Because what he said for me was true. I'm trying to hang on to some kind of individuality. And the very first thing he said to me was something shitty. He didn't interview me and kind of get a feel for my case so that he could adjust himself a little bit to approach me in a fashion that would make this transition into sobriety a little smoother for me, you know? Where the hell is that? Where's my Minnesota multiphasic thousand question thing to find out what kind of career path I should go on or something, you know? Jesus. So I said, be at my house at Thursday at 5 o'clock. Read the doctor's opinion. Make notes in the margin about what you agree with and what you don't agree with. And we'll discuss it. So I did my homework. I showed up at his house. He didn't trust me that I'd read it, so he had me read it to him out loud. This stranger, not charging me any money. I don't even think I knew his last name. He never asked me mine. And we read it. And in the doctor's opinion, it describes four or five different kinds of alcoholics. And he stopped me. He says, which one are you? And we discussed it a little bit. And I said, well, I think I'm this one here. He says, well, circle it. Put a star next to it. You're in the book. My favorite subject. And he explained to me, he said, you should identify with this book. You should find yourself in here. And you say you have, so you've passed the first test. You're in the book. This book isn't written to you, it's about you. And you should find yourself, and you've identified, you know. There you go. Well, later on in that chapter, it says the only thing that's going to save a poor guy like that, like me, is a complete psychic change. And he explained to me that as my sponsor, that was his job. To help bring about, to guide me through this path that would bring about this psychic change that would make me comfortable in sobriety so that I could survive you and move on and live a full, rich life. That was his job. He says, now we can sit around and discuss what you think your problems are if you want to. And I'd be happy to do that so that you will not share about them in the meetings. If the meetings are not about how your day went, it's about recovery from alcoholism. So I didn't know that there was an easier, softer way. I didn't know that there were people that said, if you asked them to be your sponsor, they'd say, well, yeah, sure, give me a call. You know, I thought everybody was going to class just like me. You know, I didn't know that I'd fallen in with the right-wing death squad faction of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, these people do not believe that this is a program of suggestions. They believe that there's some stuff you've got to do around here if you want to stay around here. Stuff like that. I didn't know that there was a whole therapy section you could go to, you know? I didn't know that. I just followed blindly. Where else was I going to go? So each week I showed up at this man's house and he worked the steps with me. And he took me into Alcoholics Anonymous. He took me to the meetings that he went to. Earlier we were talking about, I was his driver for years. He said, the reason I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous is that you guys needed better transportation and I had a car. I drove him around, you know. He called me one night. He did AA with me. He didn't just talk to me about it. I believe that this man literally, literally saved my life. Literally. Not just figuratively, not just a way of speaking. He saved my life. Did he sober me up? No. He helped me stay sober through his example, through the way he lives. He took me into his house because he has nothing to hide. I heard later somebody said, I take him home. Do I have something to hide? Well, I started taking him home. I thought, shit, maybe I'm hiding something, you know? But he did it with it. One night he called me up. He said, God is drunk in Wilmington and he needs us. Now, I've taken a lot of LSD. And no one ever said anything as bizarre as that. And when he says that kind of stuff, he giggles. There's like a giggle in it, you know? And he came and got me. We went to Wilmington. We picked up God and took him to the Ilano Club, you know? Figured, what? Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. You know? So we worked the steps. There's only one program. There's only one path. It says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed the path. Let me describe the path to you. The path is about 30 feet wide. And it's light brown gravel, nice and smoothed and raked. And there's little white stones on it. It's kind of like summer camp. Remember summer camp with the little white rocks and the path to the cafeteria? It's like that. It's straight as a string. There's no curves in it. It doesn't wind or anything. So that when you come in out of the jungle, you walk up to it and you go, oh, look at the path. It's big. And there's no confusion as to which way to go on the path because there's a whole bunch of people going that way. There's the path. I wonder where they're going. So you step up on the path. Now, when you're walking along the path, if you fall down, we will reach down and pick you up, mostly to get you out of the way. But we will help. We will help. We try to keep things moving. You know? Now, you can step over the stones and go off the path, and there's like little low brush and stuff and some little potholes, but there's no trees or anything or big. But you can walk along there, and you kind of stumble and fall, and you go slower, and we look at you and you go, what the hell's he doing over there? But we all kind of know because we've all been over there. And we didn't know why we were there either, especially when you get back in the path, you go, what the hell was that? Well, just because she goes over there doesn't mean you have to, too. So you can wander along and you can kind of almost keep up with us and you can go deeper off into the brush. And then what you run into is like little timber, like pole timber, like ash trees. They're kind of small diameter like this, sort of close together. So now you start bumping into them. You get scratched and stuff because there's twigs that stick out. And You know, you can get to the point in these little ash trees where you can't see us, but you can hear us because we never, ever stop talking. So you can go over there and you can hear the voices and you can leave breadcrumbs and pieces of string and stuff and find your way back, you know. And a lot of us get off into the trees and we end up coming back. Not everybody disappears forever. You can walk off into the darkness and down in the valley and across the stream and way off into the jungle. And we will miss you when you go. We will miss you, but we will forget about you. Eventually, we will forget about you. Well, what was his name? You know? Well, remember, oh, yeah, that guy, the cop. Yeah, I wonder what happened to him, you know? Because there's lots of other people coming in all the time, you know, to take the place of those that wander off into the brush. Some of them come back and we tell things like they have arrows in them and stuff. And, you know, we look at them and go, what's out there? And they go, never mind. You know, some of you limp, lose body parts and stuff, you know, and but that's the path. There's no confusion. It's not rocket science. It's straight ahead. They're numbered 1 through 12. And the 12 steps are 20% of the program. Just 20%. It's sobriety 101. You've got to do those to do the work. Alcoholics Anonymous is not therapy. It is not a self-help program. It's something else. It's spiritual. We don't know much about that, and we try to think about it, to flesh it out. You know? I went to my sponsor at 7 years sober, and I had some kind of an emotional collapse of some sort. Only in hindsight do you realize this, you know? It's kind of what teenagers go through. I believe that we're emotionally immature, and that's what's happening here as we're growing up. And there's guaranteed we're not going to do it and look good. So I went to my sponsor, and I had written some stuff down. I was in such pain, I actually wrote some shit down. And, you know, and I'm speaking at meetings and sponsoring half the South Bay. At the time, I was president of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I took it over from Rocky Hudson, remember? Rocky was president, and I became president. Who's president now? Poor. Good luck. Yeah. I think in the South Bay we have a different president. I don't recognize that guy. And I went to him and I had written some stuff down and I hadn't talked to him in months. You don't talk to your sponsor when you're president of AA really very much. And you certainly don't have any problems. And I went to him and I read him my stuff and he looked at me. We were at a retreat and he looked at me and he said, go find God. And I said to him, I said, please, Jay, I want some real help. Don't give me these mindless platitudes. I'm not some goddamn newcomer. I need some real help. And he got up, because sometimes you have to get up to talk to me. And he got in my face and he screamed in my face and he said, there is nothing else. Now, you talk a good game, go do it. Because there's nothing else. My problems don't require a whole lot of analysis. My problems are always centered in self and who I think I am. If you want to address all of your character defects, sponsor people. Yeah. You'll run into all of them. Prejudice, intolerance, impatience, lust, greed, all of it. All of it. You'll run into all of it. Make the amends and work with others. And you will fix yourself over a few decades. You know? If you're 3 years sober and you're working on your third inventory, throw it away. You've missed it. Go help someone else do theirs. This is not about me working on myself. I finally get relief from that. I don't have to do that anymore. All I have to do is work on you. That's the 80% of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, is me working with others. It's not me working the steps. That is the steps. That is the program. That's what the Oxford group gave us. I think the single most significant relationship in my entire life is that of mine with my sponsor. I've seen people look at me with respect in their eyes. That's a special thing. You'll hear stuff like people will say, put yourself at the top of your amends list. You were your own worst enemy. I was your worst enemy. If you want to make amends to yourself, put yourself at the bottom of the amends list. By the time you get there, you'll have some self-esteem. Most people in Alcoholics Anonymous do not make the amends. Most of them do not really do an inventory. Most of them. That's my opinion. I've been sober long enough now and done this rant long enough now where a lot of people come up to me with 8 and 9 years sober now and say, I want to work the steps. I said, haven't you done it before? And they go, not like you talk about. Not like that. I wrote a little life story and told my mom I was sorry. If you really want the gift, if you want the spiritual awakening that's available to us in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's in the street. It's not in the meetings. It isn't enough to be a CSR or a GSR or a secretary of a meeting or clean up after a meeting. Those things are all good. I've done all those things. But that's not enough. We're here to save the brothers and sisters. That's what we're here for. That's why we were saved. There's a mission for us. There's work to do here. And it isn't work on me. That isn't what I'm here for. I was saved for a purpose. There's a reason for me to be here. There's someone out there that needs you. Not me. They can't handle me. Look how I act. They need you. They're waiting for you. If there's anything that stands in your way of doing the work, of doing the one-on-one work with another alcoholic, get rid of that. Work on that. It's a good use of the will. That's what we're here for. Don't succumb to the lie of that there's many ways to be of service and I'm just not one to sponsor people. Don't believe the lie. That's a lie. That's why you're here, is to work with others. That's the purpose for your sobriety. The reason that you're still alive is to work with the ones that come in. There's a wonderful poem that Sam Shoemaker wrote called I Stand by the Door. Matter of fact, Alex's friend Neil in Scotland faxed it to me the first time I ever read it. And he talks about standing in the hallway. I stand by the door for the groping hands that come down looking for the door, looking for the door to God. And I can put their hand on the door, but I can't open it for them. But it's my job to stand by the door and wait for them to come. They need someone to guide them through the door. They can't find it by themselves. We are the instruments of God's will. The hope that comes on in people's eyes comes from us. They get it from us. We are the program. We aren't the big book. We're not. We are it. We're the ones that say the words that they hear. They see our lives and they want that. At first it's the Mercedes or the wife or the money or whatever it is. But after that, if they stay long enough, that isn't what they're looking for. They want peace. Isn't that what we want? The peace? Isn't that what we have? Don't you hear it in the room when you hear the laughter of the angels? I stood back by the door before I came up here and I just listened to you. You can feel it. The demon can't live here. It'll die here. My job is to stand by the door. I was standing outside the Ilano Club and there was a wino. Had been coming around and eating the cookies and drinking the coffee. And we were three or four of us were standing and he was drunk this one night. My sponsor went up to him and said, if I find you a bed, will you go? And the guy goes, yeah, sure. And the wino wandered off. My sponsor went to make a phone call, and I said to this guy standing there, what are we wasting our time with this guy for? And the guy looked at me and he goes, who the hell are you? What do you think you are? What do you think this is? If this guy can't come to AA, where the hell can he go? He says, that's what I looked like when I got here. You know, where do you think you are? What do you think this is all about? That's a good question, isn't it? Where the hell do I think I am? Why am I here? To fix me? No. Isn't there something bigger here? Isn't it bigger? Isn't it what Jesus talked about and Buddha and Muhammad? All of them, when you read it all, what did they do? They taught the people. They saved the souls. They worked with the lepers. They didn't hang around in church. They worked with the lepers and the thieves. They were street preachers. They saved the people. They tried to help the people. They went and got them. This guy said to me, what do you think you are? What do you think? Who do you think he is? My sponsor comes back and says, go get your car. I go get the car. I come driving up. They throw the guy's bedroll in the car. They put him in the front seat. No one else gets in the car. I think that's against the AA manual. You know? That was a bad thing you did. So they say, take him to the way back in, don't stop for nothing. So I thought, as I'm driving this guy away, that, you know, he's going to stab me and eat me and rape me or something. You know? I never for an instant thought that maybe he was a little frightened. Never crossed my mind that he wondered who the hell I was, where the hell he was going. But we had that conversation in the car where he said to me, what happened to me? I was married, I had kids, and what happened to me? And I looked over at him, and underneath all the hair and the matted stuff, he wasn't much older than me, maybe even younger. He just looked bad. By the time I got to the way back in, I was holding his hand. It was my own personal alcoholic. And we got him checked in, and I drove home, and that night I said a prayer, and it wasn't a prayer of thank God it's not me. It's thank you, God, for letting me know it is me. I connected. You're my people. It's not so lame anymore. When it was my chip, it wasn't stupid. When it was my birthday, it was real special. And now, I know who you are when you get up and take the cakes. I know your stories. You're my people. I love you. I really do. I never thought there'd be a time in AA where I could say that and mean it. But it's the truth. I've come home. My father died last year, and I was able to make amends to him. 10 years later, he made amends to me. Don't leave before the miracle. And when he was dying on his deathbed the last 6 months, I was able to hold him and change his diapers, and there was no more pain between us. We were buddies. We were friends. I got to be my dad's friend, finally. Alcoholics Anonymous is a wonderful thing, but it's something that you do, not just agree with. If you really want the gift that it has to offer, allow yourself to be swept away by it. Yes, it is a cult. You know? As you can see, I've shaved my head. There's two kinds of people in AA. There's those who work the steps and those who don't. Those who don't work the steps think that there's a click. And they're right. It's those who work the steps. That's the click in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you want it, all you have to do is ask. Thank you. Yeah.